It's happening again. Welcome to Work Cookie, a CBOC podcast. As we broadcast around the world, get bite-sized morsels and tidbits from our industrial organizational psychologists, other experts, and the latest research on the workplace to boost your organization's effectiveness. Sign up now at CBOC.com. That's SEBOC.com to engage with our community, gain a sense of belonging, access our other media, and get rapid advice from our experts at CBOC.com.
Welcome, I'm Dr. Jeremy Lookabaugh, Industrial Organizational Psychology Consultant and Workplace Communication and Negotiation Coach. Also, we have Tom Bradshaw with us, a voice and speech coach and a damn good actor too. He is the official voice and speech coach for the Industrial Organizational Psychology community.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to Work Cookie, our weekly gatherings of IRs, HRs, recruiters, and one actor as we try to make the world of work just a little bit better. And today, Jeremy, just a brief announcement to start. Lauren couldn't be with us today, so we're actually going to push the next pro-social pro bono discussion ahead for a few weeks. And today we're going to sort of go open forum. I know you've got a topic to start us off with, but we'll see where it goes. I'm sure it'll be interesting.
Yeah, this is going to be, it's probably going to be one of the best episodes ever, but it's going to be a little bit choppy, super last minute change. So we're just going to ask some ad hoc questions, hoping to get a sense of a little bit of, when we talk about IO psychology, how the academic part, which is, you know, like the bread and butter of it, how that plays in to the workplace and how we transfer that. And also, and anyone, please jump in today. We'd love to know why people chose instead like academia over straight workforce or consulting or vice versa. And if anyone is doing either of those in order, do you have plans to switch later on? So if you're doing workplace now and consulting, do you have plans on taking that experience and that knowledge into academia down the road while continuing, of course, as many professors do, to work on the side? Also want to get an idea, just some questions so that everyone can start thinking. I was thinking, you know, in a perfect world, if you had an audience, and for those listening on the podcast, we have it's an open mic Work Cookie event every Thursday at noon. We have a lot of experts here. We have in IO psychology, and we also have a lot of people that are interested in IO psychology. So we're trying to be mindful with our entire audience with all of this, and also, of course, people saying, "Hey, what can IO psychology do for my particular workplace?" So one of the questions to get everyone thinking is, in a perfect world, if you could have maybe put on an event or have the ears of your ideal client or the ideal person that you like to work with, and you know that they would take in absolutely everything you say, learn it, understand it, and it would have immediate and lasting behavior change, which is ideal, Tom. But we're human. What would that be? What would you tell them? So what are those key tips? And it can be to other people that are in the field of IO psychology. It could be to your ideal client. It could be to your boss, to your coworkers. Thinking very broadly of all the different focus areas and study areas of IO psychology. And yeah, I want... Dr. Spector, we have Dr. Paul Spector here today, which is a huge blessing for us, especially with this idea of the academic piece. So I want to start out, Dr. Spector, this is what I really want to know. How are people that are largely in academia, the professorships, how are they bridging that gap between the academic part, the student part, the study part, and the outside consulting part? What are the percentages? And give us an idea of how that works. How does that translate?
It's evolved over time. So when I was a student in the 70s, most IO faculty members were doing at least a little consulting on the side. You know, they didn't want to just be in the academic world. But it's evolved over time to where now I would say most IO faculty members in universities have little or no connection outside of academia. A lot of the programs, of course, this varies with the program, but a lot of the programs, at least the ones that are very research oriented, that want to train academics, there's very little training in practice. within graduate school. You know, there's not a lot of coursework in it. Maybe it touches on it a little bit. Usually the students who want to go into practice wind up getting all of that in their internship. But if you look at the academic literature, it has drifted. So you know, I've done some comparisons where I'll go back to, you know, JAP in the 70s and look at what's in there compared to what's in there now. In fact, I've done a talk at a few schools where I show them the comparison. If you look at the titles in the 70s, they were clearly dealing with work problems, you know, how to motivate employees, you know, how to better recruit them, how to better train them, very practical questions. There was some theory, you know, it wasn't just that, it wasn't practice, it was research. And now you read these titles, I mean, half the time, I don't know what they're talking about. I don't know what these things are that they're talking about. And it's so abstract and theoretical that it's hard to bridge to practice. So, you know, PSYOP tries to create those bridges. And, you know, I talk about, well, we need more, we need to communicate it better as if the problem is that the practitioners don't understand it. Well, if the practitioners and IO psychologists, they understand it, they got the same training. It's just that the papers are and the research is irrelevant.
So, Tom, we talk about this often. Dr. Patty Delgado, she mentioned that there is a 15 to a 17 year gap, Dr. Spector, in terms of when research is conducted, in terms of when it's put into use in the workplace. How does that sound to you? Do you see that as being truthful? Mm-hmm.
I think that if you go back, for the work that does get used, I wouldn't be surprised if there is a big gap because it takes a while for it to filter in. Now, it may get better now because you have a lot of other web-based outlets. So you have people blogging, you have people doing podcasts. And so there's a lot better dissemination outside of academia, because there are people that are blogging about research that are making an effort. And there is some research that's very relevant. It's not that none of it's relevant. It's just that a large proportion of it isn't relevant. And I like to think, I write a textbook, so I'm revising it every few years. And for a textbook, which is really aimed at a more generic audience, it's at the level of a practitioner who may not know a lot about psychology or IO psychology. And I find that the top journals, the JAPs, I have a really hard time finding anything in there to stick in a textbook. It's so complicated. It's models, all this complicated statistics. Sometimes when I go down to a lower tier journal, I actually find more. So International Journal of Selection and Assessment, probably it's like a third tier journal, but it's got lots of very practical stuff in there that works really well in a textbook and probably would be much more useful to practitioners.
I see. On that note, and you know, for everyone here, please feel free to raise your hand. How much in practice are you using? Are you going back to the research? For those of you that are regular, every podcast episode, we start out with, you know, at no fewer than one and sometimes 3, 4, 5 different research articles. And we use those as the basis because they're great discussion topics. It's very interesting to see, you know, the settings and that the research taking place. And then we tie it directly, of course, into these workplace concepts. So how often? Because the question is then, once you've graduated, once you've conferred your degree, you've got your master's degree, you've got your PhD, are there many of you out there that are saying, look, I've got it down, I've got the understanding of it, and because I am a PhD, for example, I have the critical thinking skills and I have the research skills to not necessarily have to take these organizational issues and go back and look at, you know, correlations and all these fun things? Or are you actively going and saying, hey, let's look at some research onto this very particular topic? Tom, I've shared this with you. It's an oldie but goodie. Tom, can I share it again? You don't even, the answer is yes, but you don't know what it is yet. I was working with a resorts company and they were having trouble with they couldn't pay their servers more, and they were having a hard time hiring servers, but they needed, and they're, I'm sorry, they're having a lot of turnover. So how can we get our servers more money? And I went and just did some easy things, some easy looking into some of the research. And I found some really interesting studies, because psychology is wildly fascinating. And that's why so many people get their bachelor's degree in liberal arts and psychology, because it's fascinating. They just, it's hard to figure out what to do with it after the fact. And I found a couple studies that were interesting. One was if a server says, thank you for allowing me to serve you today, enjoy blank day. It's supposed to be beautiful. Whatever the next good day was supposed to be with weather. They received something like a 20% increase in tips on average, because it broke the natural fear response when someone was writing their tip in. So there you go. Now you have something, it's been studied, and you have something that you can try for real, true results. They also, another similar study that I looked for that particular operation was, is it best to have 5-star service and just absolute great service, always being there to refill your water, just absolutely great service? Or what would happen if they simply repeated back the order to the customer? Because that way the customer felt heard and understood. Well, they found that one, they got something like at least in the 30% on average more tips, because they made the customer feel heard and understood. They repeated back word for word their entire order over the 5-star service. So these are very applicable, and there's so many fascinating studies out there. One of the books I recall now, it's called The Willpower Instinct. I think it's Dr. Kelly McGonigal, if I'm not mistaken. Packed and packed and packed with just fascinating, fascinating research studies on smoking cessation, on weight loss, on all kinds of things. But when you really look at the studies that are out there, they're wildly interesting. And I wonder if it's our job as a psychologist to, get back to basics sometimes and look at these studies, share them in the workplace, but make them come to life, tell the story around them to help get that buy-in. What does anyone think on this?
Well, I just like the idea of bringing narrative to anything. Anytime you want to, influence people, it's always great to have narrative there and tell them story. I think we should all become great storytellers, just as a way to get people more buy-in. If you can establish that relationship with another individual through stories, through using your voice, you're going to get much more buy-in. So whatever information you're going to bring to the table is actually going to be more effective. So, I'm the communication guy. I had to step up and just say that. Let's go to Rich.
So I just started adjunct teaching this year, right? So I have a little bit of understanding now of what's going on in the academic world there, so the textbook that I was drawing from, it doesn't mention a whole lot of, there's nothing on AI, and there's nothing having to do with, very little on marketing automation and some other things that are fairly new, right? So, and this is a marketing thing that I'm teaching, right? So I can see that having some, practical experience from, somebody who's in the field can really help enrich our learning and those that are practicing, that are adjuncts, can learn from, what they're teaching the students, because I'm getting that right now, where, I think having that one foot in academia and the other foot in practice, is really helping me, at least to bridge that. And my students have said that, when I can show them in real life, this is what a CRM system does, and this is what, my marketing automation looks like, that they can actually see that, we're not just dealing with theoreticals here. We're actually dealing with things that actually work. I found in my studies in IL psychology that when I was working with an adjunct that was also, working in the field as a consultant, we really, had a good feeling, because they could relate stories of their clients, not disclosing who their clients were necessarily, but they would share stories of, if we're talking about something in organizational development, here's a project that I worked on, and relating the theory to, what's actually happening. And I've actually found that I'm doing the same thing in an OD project I'm working on right now, so I don't know. I think there's a lot of value in having one foot in each one of those practice areas.
Yeah, I agree. It's nice to have one foot in each in each area, unless one of those feet is on fire. Then it gets a little uncomfortable. Tabitha, welcome to Work Cookie. Let's go to you.
Hey, so to kind of couple off of what Dr. Jeremy said when it comes to research, I love the story with the server. And that is actually what led me into getting my master's in IO psychology, not a server aspect, but working in healthcare. And while I was in healthcare, I was always curious on all this research they were putting to that patient's psychological safety. And it almost muted the employee psychological safety. So as we talk about research applying, I'm always curious on what that employee perspective is. How are they feeling for this impact? And now working as a change management consultant, I have the opportunity to use that research and say, okay, I care about my stakeholders for sure. I want to make sure that their definition of success is met, but how is this impacting the employee? And how is their psychological safety, change saturation, meeting saturation, communication saturation being handled in these processes as well?
You know, I'd be interested to ask you, Tabitha, you know, especially when we're talking about, you know, the safety, psychological safety of employees, we're getting new information all the time. You know, it just does seem to be changing. So how current is the research that you're accessing?
Well, working in healthcare, there wasn't a lot of research on employee psychological safety, which is really fascinating. And the research that I was able to find was mostly out of country. A lot of the focus was on that patient psychological safety and the impact it had on their longevity and care and deliverable outcomes for success. And it's interesting that so much was focused while continually understaffing employees. Obviously, a lot of this initiative and research was done prior to COVID. Working now as a change manager, I'm not in the healthcare space. I think I would be too much of a bias to work in that field, to be quite honest.
Well, at least you are honest. healthcare institutions are more concerned about their patients than their employees.
Naturally,
until they end
right?
up as patients.
Naturally, they should be, right? Concerned about the patient. That is their, you know, customer. However, in order for that patient to have success, their employees need all the things, right, to provide that success and outcome. And one of those things is psychological safety, the opportunity and ability to speak up when things aren't going appropriately for that patient.
Well, Jeremy, this is the common story of, you know, organizations are worried about their customers, just not the people who serve them.
With what, before I do have a comment for that, I do want to put a bug for Dr. Spector. I was thinking, what are some of the most interesting studies or study results? It makes me thinking back to like the server example. And then Aaron has a great history of firefighting. And Aaron, if I might put you on the spot, if you can, when you're ready, just raise your hand and share what are some of the things that you're seeing in that particular, I guess, industry, if you would call it an industry, but in the public service and how IO can be applied. I'll respond to what Tom and Tabitha were mentioning about, I've seen a huge difference. I was telling somebody the other week, wow, healthcare has really taken a turn in the past 15 to 20 years. I mean, you've got places now you go in a, you know, you're in a waiting room and somebody comes by and they're saying, hey, I'm the volunteer. Can I get anyone a Mountain Dew? Can I get anyone some cookies, some water? And they're walking around like patient care. They're really focusing on the experience because, like what Tabitha said, it's a customer is what it is. And they're really starting to focus on that. We might jump to Paul. I see your mic's off. Do you have some things to share? And then we can go over to Matthew.
First, in healthcare, I lucked into a job in a local academic hospital, which is, I retired from the psychology department. And now I do that and do a little teaching. And the CEO likes to say, we take care of employees and our employees take care of the patients. And so he's huge on psychological safety. So we do research on the things we do. We do interventions and we do research. And one of the main variables we look at is psychological safety. But I don't know how widespread that thinking is. I just got lucky in falling into this in a place that that's pretty forward thinking. In terms of your question about things that sort of come to mind about, I mean, there's lots of classic research like goal setting, for example. And so there's research going back 50 years that not only show that goals work, but show the conditions under which they work best. So, for example, participation in goal setting, setting challenging but not ridiculous goals, that sort of thing. We know about pay for performance. We know it increases motivation, but it also increases stress. And so there's really is a lot, you know, there's a lot in leadership and teams. There is a lot of research out there, and a lot of it isn't new. You know, a lot of it goes back decades. I think one challenge for academics is that to get published, you have to do something new. And a lot of the there's been so much done. I mean, the low-hanging fruit's been picked. And so people are trying to figure out a new little twist. And often it winds up to be something that isn't really any more helpful than what we already knew.
On that note, sorry, Tom. Oftentimes we find that when we're sharing research here on these open mics, it often becomes a roadmap because some of this research is it's very, very specific in terms of themes, in terms of factors, and it's very well broken down. And we've found that we can take one piece of one particular article and almost say, look, if you're in an organization and you're struggling to figure out how to create an employee development program, for example, it'll list the things that are important, the different factors. Mm-hmm. What do you say to that idea about using research kind of as a roadmap, maybe looking at a couple of different pieces of research to see what fits the company, but it can play almost as a starting point and at least get the ball rolling, some kind of a template, some kind of a process for organizations?
Yeah, that's, I teach executives and that's exactly what I tell them. When they ask me, why are we reading these academic papers? There's nothing in it that's useful. And I said, well, there's two things that are that you might get out of it. One is, tools, measures. You know, they often have a lot of measures in them and a lot of methods of doing things, and those can be useful, even if the findings aren't. And the second, which is exactly what you said, Jeremy, is the place to start. If you're interested, for example, in retention, and there's a paper on turnover, it's a, well, here's six things that are related to it. And although this research might not tell you that those are actually driving it, it's a place to start. You can think about, okay, these are the factors to start with and start thinking about how can we manipulate these factors in a way that's going to increase retention.
I like it. Some validation there, Tom. What do you think?
It's always good when you feel good, Jeremy. Matthew, you had your hand up.
I have awesome conversation. I love that it's off the cusp here, not really planned out too much. One of the things that I absolutely love to do is find ways to bridge that connection between the academic research and the theory and practical application. Great, we do all this research and it sounds wonderful, but when it sits on a shelf, does it really contribute and bring value to the community? And so any opportunity, any time that we can actually connect those two things, it has an awesome impact, but it just makes it gets me really excited. I get super focused in on that. But to go to build off of what Tabitha was talking about with psychological safety and the focus on the patients and the customers, it reminded me of a story that I had heard about a consultant who had worked for a highly reputable customer service oriented organization. They learned this individual learned all the ins and outs of how to deliver amazing customer service, tried to bring that into the healthcare industry, and the doctors and nurses and organizations basically said, we don't care. We're in it to make money and help and heal people. Well, then the ACA rolled out, the Affordable Care Act rolled out, and part of that reimbursement to hospitals and doctors' offices said patient satisfaction is going to be a critical element. So now all of a sudden these leaders are going, how do I keep my patients happy? How do I keep my doctors happy? Because happy doctors treat happy patients. And there's all sorts of academics that were looked at as far as, well, if you do this and if you do that, what the consultant found out, what as I started to just sit and observe, which is what we kind of do as consultants when we go out in the field, we have all this knowledge, but sometimes we just sit and watch. We sit and observe and say, I have so many things that I could use, but I don't know what's going to be appropriate for you. As they watched, one of the things they noticed was doctors would come in with their chart, and they're looking at the chart, talking to the patient, but still looking at the chart. So I see you have this, I see you have that. Okay, we're going to get this test done and that test done. Have a good day. And there they go. And the satisfaction scores were mediocre. Something as simple as coming in, being approachable, sociable, and generous. Sitting at their level. Take 2 seconds, look at the chart, but then look at them and say, "Hi, Tom, how are you today?" Having a genuine conversation and connection didn't take too much extra time, but the result was an extremely significant increase in patient satisfaction, also an increase in doctor satisfaction, employee satisfaction, because their intention was now, I can build a connection with somebody. I don't have to just look at the chart, assign a test, and move on. And so it's really interesting and fascinating how when we come into organizations, whether we are in the organization or coming from the outside, that ability to just sit and observe and watch and say, I have all these theories, I have all this education, but what's going to make most sense in this situation, the impact that it can have. And really, you know, it's that storytelling, and it's finding ways to be approachable. There's and speak the language of the audience that you are with whom you're talking. We can come in and say, here's all the benefits of retaining your employees. But if you're talking to somebody that only cares about the bottom line, finding a way to put it in their perspective is going to have a huge impact.
Yeah, you know, I'm very happy with my current doctor because he's willing to have a relationship with me. It's not just like I took my car to the, you know, the garage and he's checking the oil. Aaron, we're going to come to you in a second, but Lydia, you've got your hand up first. So let's go to you.
Sure. First of all, fascinating conversation. I'm so glad to hear that as experts and doctors that we are interested in actually making or creating information that is usable. Done a PhD program or started one several years ago, and they were appalled by having the public contact them and asking them for help with their organizations. And the response was, I'm so sick of people asking me to give them something they can use and plug in. It's not a toaster what I do. So I'm really glad to hear that this conversation is going this way, and also makes me happy that I didn't continue with that doctorate and chose INO instead. On the second note, I'm actually working in government, in which we see our customers, because some things happened a few years ago that caused us to kind of take a step back and look at internally how we were functioning. So needless to say, we created a division of health equity and social justice that looks at what's going on inside the organization. And then afterwards, we'll be looking at how our work impacts the community.
That is so great to hear. The government organizations are actually starting to get on board. Aaron, we're going to come to you next. But Jeremy, did you want to once again remind us of the question that you asked Aaron?
Thanks. Yeah, Aaron has a great and extensive history in public service and firefighting. And he has a particularly, he's well employed. He's a close referee to that particular situation. And he has a great passion for IO psychology in terms of how that can be applied to leadership, to training, and those kinds of things. So I thought he'd be great, since he's here today, to speak on that.
All right, Aaron, the show's yours.
All right. Hey, how's it going? Can you hear me?
Yep.
All right, cool. So just as you're saying, I've been in the fire service for a little over 11 years now. Currently functioning in two different positions, one as a lieutenant and another as a chief training officer. The concept of, you know, how we can apply IO psychology to the fire service, I mean, essentially is just on the overall professional development. You know, as I mentioned in the comments earlier, one of the things that we always, you know, will speak to each other about is having that, you know, mission focused and data driven type mindset. You know, our mission across the board is to ultimately serve and protect the community. We place our community first, we place them ahead of ourselves. And we rely heavily on our data. You know, it's been the past 5 years, we have updated and modified the methods on how we perform CPR, just by focusing solely on the patient and not the monitor, so to speak. You know, going back on the discussion about like doctors and everything, and you know how they walk in the office and just solely focus on their chart. You know, that's, I've seen it numerous of times, and it could be a simple, you know, me responding to a smoke alarm call, and the guys are just solely focused on, all right, yeah, we got to change these batteries. Okay, cool, bye. No, that's not gonna. Yeah, we're helping the public out in that matter, but they're not gonna want to trust us or be comfortable approaching us that next go around when they truly do need us. I don't want to, you know, tie up too much time on this. I could go for hours upon hours discussing, you know, the relevance of psychology in the fire service. So, yeah.
Well, thank you for your service and for everything you do. An unsung hero for sure. Jeremy, back to you.
I took the liberty of just doing a quick scholar search and looking up some of the research, right? So there's one, first one that pops up, development and validation of the fire service safety climate scale. So, I mean, you want to talk about some psychometrics in here, but it's broken down, and yeah, it's tough to read for people who aren't used to looking at all this type of data. But when you break it down, if I can find, where'd it go? It breaks it down because, of course, there's your physical things like getting sick and where did it go? There it is. So you look at safety outcomes, right? The tangible types of things, injury rate, safety, compliance. Then you look at some of the other things they list as well-being outcomes, job satisfaction, IO, burnout, IO, engagement, IO, management commitment, which goes more towards the goes to all of it. And then of course you have your supervisor support. So these are all perfectly situated, and anyone, whether it's the fire department, whether it's the police department, whether it's, you know, public water and sewer, there's all kinds of studies directly related, whoever's here, whoever's listening, directly related, I would guess, right to the particular field that you're in. And there's so much that you can find. Just some other things. moving focus, the fire service organizational culture of safety survey. So lots of different surveys. You've got an exercise in fire safety, readying ourselves for unintended consequences of traditional IO approaches and diversity management. It's in the history of IO psychology. I mean, you look at the history of IO psychology, it's really built off of government services and the services, whether it be military, police, firefighter, in terms of selection. So there's so much here. Even this, where have all the workers gone? Oh, that's not firefighting. That's here, principals. I lost the I hit the wrong page. But you get what I'm saying. Whatever industry you're in, there's a roadmap there. There's a starting point, and there's something that you can use that's specific, because we talk about generalizability. Tabitha mentioned about the healthcare studies, how they're in other countries. So we do have this concept, of course, to look at of generalizability when you look at, okay, how is this specific to our particular workforce, a company of our size? So there's different things like that are important that, you know, in order to look at, because do these particular results, would they be the same with a different population? And sometimes we have to just take a best guess and maybe apply if there's nothing better, or maybe we reach out to academia to conduct a study, which happens all the time, because they want, okay, there's a study here, but we want one for these particular demographics and this particular location. So there's all kinds of ways to continue to make sure that you're getting the most accurate and current results for your particular industry. Tom, I'll turn it back to you.
Thank you very much, Jeremy. We're going to go to Rich next, and then Dr. Matthew. And Lydia, I see you still have your hand up. If you've got more to add, we're going to come back to you after Dr. Matthew. So, Rich, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think you hit on something there, Jeremy, on these industry-specific cases, right? So One of the things that I've found helpful in my understanding of some of the industries that I serve, right, is actually through trade publications and the associations that serve, you know, these specific industries. It's one of the nice parts about IO work rather than individual work in psychology, right, is that we actually have some categorized groups of people that are in these these associations, by industry, right? So I can learn some very specific ways to tailor organizational development in manufacturing by going into a manufacturer's association and learning from some of the reports that they pull out into their journals. And I was part of the Coin Laundry Association for a while, and I actually was able to get industry data from that to help guide some of the work that I've done with laundry owners before. I think that there's still some rigor, some academic rigor that happens within these associations. I rely heavily on like SHRM. And I really liked when 2017, when SHRM was working with PSYOP, because they put some really nice white papers together. And I don't know why they stopped doing that, because I found those incredibly insightful, because I really took from the HR perspective and the IO perspective and smashed them together into something that like was relatable, and you could actually like put it into real situations. So I guess case in point, the folks at CBOC, right? I mean, we're all learning from each other. We're outside of that academic world, and we're all as peers. We're pulling things together and using critical thinking to kind of solve how our careers move, or what can we do to help our clients. So I guess to distill that down, associations could be a good thing.
And Dr. Matthew, over to you.
Building off of what Rich said, and also including some of what Dr. Jeremy had said, I see that there's so much academic research and information that's out there, and I don't know how I kind of go back and forth. There's so much information and studies and research out there, but it's hidden often behind paywalls. You have to pay to access these things. And on the one hand, I think if we can offer this out and provide this out there, how much greater could that impact be? But then I have to sort of reel it back in and remind myself, with great power comes great responsibility. And that's where our job as IOs in the field is to be that bridge that connects that academic research to practical application. Because this information, it when we look at psychology and how people behave and all the positive benefits to it, we would be naive to turn our heads and turn our eyes away from the potential to go the other way. PsyOps to go the other way, where all of a sudden it's used for not so great purposes. And so that's where I don't know how I feel about that. Keeping it behind a paywall ensures that those who know how to responsibly administer it, deliver it, communicate it, integrate it, we have that capability. But then at the same time, not everybody in that community has that access. And so I don't know. I just wanted to throw that out there and see what others thought about that.
Well, I'm sure we'll get some good response on that. Lydia, back to you. Oh, maybe Lydia is in listening mood. We'll see if she comes back. Tabitha, let's go to you.
Yeah, I just wanted to bounce off what Dr. Matthew just said. I love that insight. And I think that's where I was coming from with speaking up about that patient psychological safety versus employee. To back up a little bit, I was a respiratory therapist and a combat medic in the military. Transitioned, I did total 15 years as a respiratory therapist. So I saw the movement before patient psychological safety of those five P's, right? Position, conversation, all those things. But as they did that information was a little twisted. And as we did the five P's, we also intentionally understaffed. And with the intentional understaffing and the five P's, the workload on the employees increased. Therefore, that psychological stress increased and the emotional labor attached to the job increased. So with great knowledge comes great responsibility. And I think that's a beautiful example and what motivated me to learn more about IO psychology and to dig deep on who made these choices, why, and that what, so what now kind of mindset around them.
Thank you very much for that. And once again, thank you for your service. I meet so many ex-military who are now IO psychologists. It's got to be something in there. Jeremy, I'm going to ask this question, and both to you and Paul as well, and anyone else who has experience working in academia. You know, and I've taught at a couple of different institutions. Speaking about psychological safety, because I'm sure there's a lot of IO psychologists who are former students who are like, maybe one day I'm going to go back and I'm going to teach. Working in academia is sometimes not pleasant. Institutions, as they move more towards a business model and less from centers of, you know, education, it becomes more and more difficult. So could one of you speak about some of the challenges maybe that you faced in the world of academia and how academia should maybe listen to their IO psychology department?
Paul, how about if I kick this one over to you?
All right. Academic departments can be challenging, but there's a lot of variation from the department to department. Some of them are delightful places to be, and some of them, you know, all it takes is one or two toxic people. But you get the same in industry. So I don't think there's really a lot of difference. Maybe the one difference is that faculty, tenured faculty, have a lot of autonomy. And so, and they get away with a lot that would be hard to get away with in a corporate setting. But there are a lot of different avenues. What I see happening a lot, because I teach in the business school now, is that there are a lot of different models. They have a lot of full-time instructors. They're not tenure earning, but they're permanent instructors. So it's a permanent position. And they mainly teach. Some of them will do a little research, but their main focus is teaching. They're under a lot less pressure than the tenured faculty. You know, if you're in a business school and you're tenured, there's a lot of pressure in research-oriented places. And of course, there's a lot of variation. There's the research ones, and then there are the teaching schools. But my experience is primarily in the research one places, and there's a tremendous amount of pressure to publish in the sacred, what's called the FT50, the Financial Times 50 journals, 50 business journals. So a lot of pressure. You go to psychology, they don't have journalists, but there's a lot of pressure to get grants. And so if you're successful at it, you know, it's a great fit. If you're not so successful at the publication and the grants, then it's an awful lot of pressure. And so my advice to someone who's contemplating after a corporate career to go back to academia is to think about instructor positions. Sometimes they're called clinical positions in a business school where they really value that practice experience and they value you for your teaching. And there's not the same pressures as a tenure earning, particularly if you're not tenured yet. Which is quite the stressful rat race for about 6 years, or it can be.
I found it very interesting teaching in the fine arts department. Not a lot of respect, but as soon as they asked me to teach a class in the School of Business, things did change. Laura, let's go to you.
I appreciate that, Tom. My father was an instructor at a university and had the same thing. His department was in IT or something, and then switched to the business school. And he was like, the amount of money, the amount of support, like it's such a transition. And I think that's why a lot of IO people tend to work in the business departments, because that's where the money is. My father's frustration that I also remember seeing as a graduate student is that the like performance standards, right, for reinforcing achieving tenure in a lot of universities does not encourage them to go out and connect with business. So my father worked in industry for a really long time and then switched to being an instructor. And he would get so frustrated with these people who have only ever lived in academia and never worked outside in business and consulting. And his kind of bread and butter as an instructor worked out with for him as an instructor was that he had those connections. He would connect his business students into the real world. He'd be able to provide case studies and connections for internships. And so he was able to bring a lot of value as a full-time non-tenured instructor because he didn't have a PhD. So tenure was never an option for him. And he didn't really want it. He was too old to care at that point. But it was interesting to hear those conversations. And as I mentioned, I remembered having those kinds of similar conversations and understanding of academia when I was a grad student and trying to decide what path to pursue. The other thing I wanted to kind of bring up, kind of tying with it, is I remember the conversations back in grad school of the delay between academic research and publication and then being able to use it in the field. And I've been trying to do research on the side. I'm trying to be a good, right, IO practitioner and do the research and applying it into my roles. And I'm running into that issue, similar to what Tabitha mentioned. The only research I can find was attached to international studies, or I was looking for measurement tools, like Paul was mentioning. I was like, ooh, I can find measurement tools to use and reference at work. But then those things weren't published, or there's not a lot in there, or it was like relating to a very different population of employees than what I'm trying to support. However, what you have all reminded me is that in my PSYOP membership, I paid for the database. So thank you to everyone for reminding me that during this call, because now I just realized I have access to EBSCOhost. I'm so excited. So I appreciate all of y'all very much. And that was my kind of 2 to 5 cents I wanted to throw in.
Worth more than a dollar. Jeremy, back to you.
It looks like all the hands have gone down. We don't have to run this out for the entire hour. I think we did an amazing job covering a lot of ground, and we had a lot of fun with this impromptu topic today. So, Tom, I'll turn it back over to you for any final thoughts, and anyone can still feel free to raise their hand.
Well, I've got another question, and this is probably for you, Paul, but Jeremy, you might want to jump in here as well. One of the things we heard early on in the show was that, you know, there's more happening in IO outside of the United States. So are there some other countries, like maybe Great Britain or the European countries, maybe over in Asia? Is there somewhere we should also be looking for advice and information that are maybe a little bit ahead of what's happening here in North America?
A lot of it depends on the topic. So if you look at, you know, if you're interested in stress and health, Northern Europe has been a leader in that area. US has caught up to a great extent, but there's still a lot of good stuff coming out of Scandinavia and Northern Europe. There's an awful lot of research these days coming out of China. So we've had, about 15, 20 years of a lot of Chinese students coming here and getting their PhDs and then staying here and becoming faculty members and then having the connections back in China. And so they're collaborating with Chinese colleagues. So a lot of work coming out of China. Most of the work that you see is published in English. It's published in the same journals. And so if you look in the journals, you see that the studies come from everywhere. The Western Europe, Northern Europe, China, Korea, Australia. I mean, the list just goes on and on. There are areas where you don't see a lot. You don't see a lot coming out of Latin America. Some, but not a tremendous amount. You don't see a lot coming out of Africa. So there are places, not so much out of Eastern Europe compared to Western Europe. So there are some areas of the world where there's a lot of work being done and some where there's a trickle, but not quite so much.
And Jeremy, you, I think you mentioned this was a while back, that the Work Cookie podcast is now being downloaded in over 100 countries. So maybe Work Cookie is one of the best ways to get the information out there.
Agreed. Yeah, well over 100 countries for sure. Last time I checked, it was 101, and that was a couple months ago. So maybe not well over 100 times, but over 100.
We're like the United Nations for IO psychology. Except we function better. Well, anyone else want to jump in with some final thoughts or a final question? Looks like everybody's happy, Jeremy.
Sounds good. I'll go ahead and count us out. So as a reminder, it'll be the February 29th. That will redo the pro-social topic, which Lauren will be here for that one. Thank you so much, everyone, for making this another great time together. Counting out in 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Work Cookie, a CBOC podcast. Don't forget to sign up at CBOC.com. That's SEBOC.com to engage with our community, gain a sense of belonging, access our other media, and get rapid advice from experts. Would it be a bad idea to make your most challenging workplace problems go away? At CBOC.com.